Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on poison drops in the federal Senate when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, our federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. 15 files on every American. And that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, business, and industry is obtaining all this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Well, knowing how this information is being gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And I'll teach you how to train yourself how to be just as personal and private as you want to be. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. That's our free general law CD package. And if you'd like to download that free general law CD package, go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And then go to our archives page and you can download that general law CD package and get that information free. All right, we're talking about a guy here by the name of Zach Montgomery. He wrote a book back in 1886. It's called Poison Drops. Poison Drops. Deals with education. Remember, Zach Montgomery was nominated for assistant attorney general, and when he went to his confirmation hearing in 1885 in the U.S. Senate, they jumped all over him like flies on stink because he held a radical view. And that view today, I don't know if it's more or less radical today than it was then, but I'll throw it out to you and see what you think about it. What if I came in and I said to you, public school causes criminality, poverty, insanity, suicide, violent criminals, and unemployment? Would you think that was pretty radical? Because all of our lives we have been told that the reason for public school, the purpose for education, is to prevent criminality, to prevent poverty, to prevent insanity and suicide, to prevent violent crime, to prevent unemployment. The very reason that we send our children to public school is to educate them so that they can fit into society and get a job and they will not be unemployment. We want them to be productive members of society, don't we? We send them to school to teach them morality, don't we? I mean, you're not sending your kid to school to teach your child immorality, are you? I mean, you're not sending your kid to school because you believe that they're teaching crime there. I mean, this isn't the mafia, you know, 101, you know, learning how to shake down or run a numbers racket or something like that now, are you? So when Zach Montgomery went into the Senate and they asked him what his views were, you know, on public education, he said, I think that parental education is the solution. Now, let me differentiate here for you and show you what this is. If we go to the Bible and we were to look in the Bible to find out what kind of an educational system did the creator of the universe have in mind, the answer is parental education in opposition to public education. The theory is that everybody is responsible for his own bread snappers. You created this child. Now feed him, clothe him, and educate him. Now, nobody wants to do that. I mean, let's be intelligent people. We all love sex, but we don't like the results of it. Sex is a great thing until the wife comes and says, oh, I'm pregnant. And then all of a sudden, you know, reality kicks in and you say, oh, my God, there's going to be another one to feed and clothe and house and take care of here, you know. You're going to have a bigger car now because my Corvette isn't big enough for, you know, the wife and myself and three kids. And so pretty soon, you know, the Corvette has to give way, you know, to a station wagon. And all of a sudden, you know, then all the prestige that goes with it and the foxy chicks, you know, that you were chasing her. A thing of the past, you know. And all of a sudden, we gotta think about, well, now I've got to feed these extra kids. I got 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, one time I had 5. I'd feed all them kids. And then I had to educate them. I sent all my kids to private school to start them off so they could learn how to read, because they don't teach phonics in public school. So I sent them to private school, make sure they could read. And then I sent them to public school so that I could teach them crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment, which worked like a shot. It's worked perfectly for my children. I'm sure it'll work perfectly for yours. Now, God had a different program in mind, and the Amish people of America follow that program. They practice parental education. And in the United States, the southern states, that is Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, North and South Carolina, and Georgia, between 1850 and 1880, they were practicing parental education, that model. And the New England states, that is, you know, New York and Connecticut and Pennsylvania and Rhode Island and Massachusetts and so on, those states, they were practicing public education. And there's a different outcome that you get from public education. And then I told you that in the last program. I said, you know, if you're looking to spend more money, you're looking then to get dumber kids, because that's what happens. And the more money we spend on public education, the dumber our children become. And Charlotte Isherby wrote a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America and documented that and wrote it about the 1990s. You know, fairly recent. And then yesterday I showed you the Yoder versus Wisconsin program here. Now, these people today, modern times, right up to, the, you know, as I speak right now, today, there are people here in the United States called Amish people. They're kind of peculiar. They dress funny, and they don't drive cars, and they all live here. They all work. And get this. When they were looking through the state of Wisconsin, and I'm sure you'll find this in Ohio and Pennsylvania as well, they were looking for how many Amish people were locked up in the prisons of Wisconsin. They couldn't find any. They were trying to find how many Amish people were on the poverty rolls, you know, on public assistance, and they couldn't find any. And they were trying to find some Amish people who were unemployed, and they couldn't find any Amish people unemployed. And they don't send their children to public school. Now, as I speak right now, listen up now, as I speak right now, all of you people who are locked up in prison right now, how many of you went to public school? And the answer is all of you people locked up in the penitentiaries and jails listening to me right now, all of you people have been to public school. Now, I'm sure that you're going to say, well, when I went to public school, they did not have any classes on crime, and they weren't trying to teach me criminal behavior. Well, they didn't tell you that that's what their intentions were, but that's exactly what they were doing. It's what we call unintended consequences. Unintended consequences. Probably your public school teacher did not intend for you to turn into a criminal and end up in prison. But just look at yourself right now. You are in prison, locked up behind those bars, and you went to public school. And the Amish people did not go to public school, and there are no Amish. Start asking the other prisoners around you right now, hey, you, hey, Bob, are you Amish? Tom, Sam, go out in the yard and start looking for an Amish prisoner in the jail that you're located in right now, and I'll bet you you're not going to find one there. If you do, boy, he's going to be one rare duck. Well, I wouldn't say you can't find an Amish man there. I mean, there could be some Amish in jail. I'm not contending that every Amish man is 100% non-criminal. There's probably some Amish guys that have killed their wives and probably stolen and one thing and another and ended up in jail, more than likely. But it is a very rare phenomenon. Now, to find an Amish guy that's on welfare is just about as rare. The insanity rate's very low, and the suicide rate's very low, and the violence is very low, and unemployment's non-existent. Those Amish people all have employment. They're all working. Now, let me ask you this. If you're listening to me right now and you're unemployed and you're looking for a job, let me ask you this. Did you go to public school? All right, you went to public school. Now, I think that would just about be all of us here in the United States of America. I don't know of anybody that didn't go to public school. I went to public school. Now, as a result of that, if you're unemployed today, ask yourself, did I go to public school? Now, next time you're down at the unemployment office to pick up your unemployment check, or the next time that you're going to a job fair or you're going someplace looking for work or something like that, start asking the people around you, hey, are you Amish? See if you can find an unemployed Amish man someplace. And I'll bet you that it's going to be a cold day in hell when you find one unemployed Amish guy. Now, all you people that are on welfare, and I know that if you're drawing WIC or you're drawing unemployment or food stamps or something like that, you probably did not intend to end up on welfare, but there you are. And I just saw a number the other day, 32 million Americans are now drawing food stamps. 32 million. Okay, well, now I'm sure that you didn't intend to go draw food stamps. But there you are, you're drawing food stamps. Now, the next time you go down to pick up your food stamps, start asking the people around you, hey, how many Amish people are in here to pick up their food stamps today? And I think you're going to find there aren't any there. Now, this isn't an altar call to join the Amish religion. I'm not here to promote Amish theology at all. I just want to point out that there's a cause and effect result that comes from this. You can go to people like the Mormons, for instance, and take a look at their statistics on their longevity. Mormons live longer, on average, than the rest of us. And they have a different lifestyle. See, they don't drink Coca-Cola, so you won't find a Coke-sucking Mormon. They don't drink coffee, so you won't find any Mormons. Now, they might run a Starbucks or something like that and sell it to you, but they're not drinking. And they don't drink booze. And so, you know, you might find a Mormon that's a boozer. There's those around here. I ran across one once one time. He used to work for him. His name was Jess Sears. He was what they call a Jack Mormon. See? He drank a little. Oh, hell, he drank a lot. He drank quite a bit. He's a painter. Painters drink a lot. But they're rare. And you're going to look a long time before you find one. And that's why I'm bringing this to your attention over here, because if you want your children to turn out to be criminals, in poverty, insane, suicidal, or violent, or unemployed, public school is the place to send them. It is a proven winner. It's been going on now for thousands of years. Public education is not something new. Solomon made an observation one time. He said, there's nothing new under the sun. Actually, that was God using Solomon to write down one of his own thoughts, but there's nothing new under the sun. And this thing of destroying people's culture through public education has been going on for thousands of years. Here in the United States, we wanted to destroy the Native American culture. We didn't like them. They were savages. So when we conquered them, we put them on reservations to isolate and segregate them from society. Then we took their children away from them and sent them to foster homes and educated them in the white man's way. We educated them to Christian theology, destroyed their religion. We educated them in our public school system to destroy their society and their culture. God, it worked like a shot, didn't it? Now, you Jews out there, you Muslims and so on, the purpose for public school is to destroy Muslim culture, Muslim religion, and Muslim society. Because that's the objective of public education. It is to mold everybody into a uniform society. That's what public education does. That's what it's for. So every day, we will bring your little Muslim children in, and we will teach them to place their hand over their heart and pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States. And when we do that, then we separate them from their past, from their culture, from their history. And we're gonna turn them into something new. This is a new product. All right, now you Christians out there, we're going to do the same thing. We are going to take your culture, we're going to take your theology, your religious ideology, and we're going to bury that, we're going to destroy it. And we do that with evolution, for instance. And we teach evolution rather than the Ten Commandments. We teach the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto in place of the Ten Commandments. We ban the Bible, and we ban prayer, and we ban all of this, and there's a reason for that. And the Amish understand that. And so in Jonas Yoder over here, in order for the Amish people to maintain their culture, they have to keep all of their members, all of their people, separate from the rest of us. Otherwise, our corrupting influence upon their society will wean them away from their customs, their traditions, their religion, their society, their history. I mean, that's just the way reality is. And so if you want to change the United States of America from a republic into a communist proletariat, you have to get hold of the public school system first so that you can mold all of the members of society from Republicans to proletariats. That's all. No fuss, no muss. And so that's what we've done. And the people of America evidently like it and want it and desire it because they send their children to public school. You can take a look at how many people in America are opposed to it. Just take a look at the number of people that attend homeschool, parochial school, and public school. Out of 58 million children in school, 50 million of them go to public school, and 3 million of them go to homeschool, and 5 million of them go to parochial school. And that just about tells you the story right there. The vast majority of Americans prefer the public school system. And that's why it thrives, and that's why it does what it does. Now, if you're one of those minorities and you say to yourself, well, I'm concerned about my child and I want to educate my child, then this book, which is called Poison Drops in the American Senate, in the Federal Senate, by Zach Montgomery, is a book that you want to get hold of. It'll help you along this line. It's reprinted by St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Again, that's St. Thomas Press, P.O. Box 35096. Houston, Texas, 77235. Now, I don't have a phone number, but let me give you another number here. When you're looking for one of these odd books and you can't find it anywhere, you go to bravenewbookstore.com. They're in Austin, Texas, bravenewbookstore.com. And this is what their business is. Their business is to put into your hands, into your grubby little hands, books that you're not supposed to read, books that are banned, books that are politically unpopular or politically incorrect. That's bravenewbookstore.com. Now, they got a phone number, too. The number is 512-480-2503. Again, that's 512-480-2503. Just tell them I'm looking for this book, and you find it for me. And they will. They'll find it. Now, there's another little trick that you can use for finding some of these odd books. The used bookstores here in America, and indeed around the world, are hooked together in the World Wide Web on the Internet. So if you walk into your local used bookstore and you tell them, I'm looking for this book, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate by Zach Montgomery, they'll plug that into the computer, and they may find a copy in South Africa. I found one there. I was looking for a book one time. I came back with a hit, and they said, well, we got one down in South Africa. Another time I got a book out of Long Beach, California. And sometimes they're a little pricey, you know, when you get one of these books that's rare and out of print. I got a book one time from 1918, last time it was published, 1918. Sometimes you got to pay $30, $40, $50, $60, you know, depends. But, you know, when you're looking for the information, I'm telling you, this is a this book here, it's only 138 pages, a little small paperback book, but it's a treatise that Zach Montgomery wrote because people ask him, well, now that you've been humiliated and made fun of, what do you got to say for yourself? And he said, okay, sit down, boys and girls, and let me tell you why I believe what I believe and what I'm doing, what I'm doing. So let's get started here. I'm on chapter 2. Let me give you a couple, three pieces of information here. Thus far, we think there can be no difference of opinion between the most inveterate supporter of the New England public school system and ourselves. Now, keeping steadily in view this common standpoint, namely that a people properly educated are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, law-abiding than an ignorant people, let us suppose that we somewhere find living side by side two communities, one of which is made up almost entirely of educated people, while the other community is largely composed of illiterate people. And let us further suppose that among those considered educated, you find that in proportion to their population, they have six criminals, to where the more illiterate community have but one. What would you think of that? Suppose that they have nearly two paupers, to where the more illiterate people have but one. And suppose that they have two insane people, to where the illiterates have only one. And suppose that their death list shows four suicides, to where that of the illiterate shows but one. And suppose that the same list shows three deaths from the criminal indulgence of the brutal passions, while that of the illiterate shows two. What conclusion would you arrive at with reference to that kind of education? Now, adhering to the proposition with which we set out a moment ago, namely that a people that are properly educated are more moral, virtuous, contented, happy, and law-abiding than an uneducated people, would you not be forced to the conclusion that there must be something wrong, terribly, radically wrong, in a system of education so much more direful in its results than even illiteracy itself? But just here, perhaps, the reader will ask us, as he has a right to ask, what application has your supposed case to the question under discussion? Well, just be patient, boys and girls, and I'll show you as we progress along. Now, for this educated community, let us take the native-born white population of the six New England states, to wit, Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And for the unlettered community, we will take the native-born whites of the six states of Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina. And it will be observed that the states thus enumerated are either a part of the original 13 or such as have been carved out therefrom. Both of these communities started on their career of existence at about the same time. Both of these communities were composed mainly of people from the same part of Europe, people who spoke the same language, and people who had the same customs, the same laws, same manners, and same usages, people who possessed the same Christian religion. Pretty much all of them, outside of Maryland, were of the Protestant faith, and they took as their religious guide the same Bible, and even the same translation of the Bible, the King James. There was one important particular, however, in which these two communities widely differed at the very start, as we shall presently see. More than 200 years ago, the principle was incorporated into the legislation of Massachusetts that the whole people must be educated to a certain degree at the public expense, irrespective of any social distinctions. Again, in Massachusetts, by statute in 1647, each town consisting of 50 householders was directed to maintain a school to teach their children to read and write, and every town of 100 families was to maintain a grammar school to fit youth for the college. The common schools of Massachusetts have been kept up to this day by direct tax and individual subscription, and nowhere in a population of equal extent has common elementary education been more universally diffused. This compulsory education system of supporting common and grammar schools in each town is sustained to this day in Massachusetts, and it is enforced by indictment. At a very early day after their settlement, a similar system of education was adopted in all of the other New England states, from which fact the system seems to have taken the name of the New England system. Chancellor Kent says that in New England it has been a steady and governing principle from the very foundation of the colonies that it was the right and duty of the government to provide by means of fair and just taxation for the instruction of all the youth in the elements of learning. On the other hand, the six enumerated states comprising what we have agreed to call the unlettered community has steadily resisted this New England system up to this very recent date. Virginia, for instance, which occupies about the same relation to the latter community that Massachusetts does to the former, according to Lippincott's Gazetteer of the World, published in 1856, Virginia had at that time no general free school system, but made an appropriation for the instruction of the poor. Thus, these two communities, the one with its New England public school system and the other without it, traveled along side by side for about 200 years until A.D. 1860, when the 8th United States decennial census was taken, and the following was the showing of these two communities, as will appear by reference to the annexed table number 1. Now, following are some tables here and statistics which are difficult to portray in over the air. So I'm going to round the numbers off, but get your pen and paper out. And let's just write down a few of these numbers. Now, remember, I started today with our dialogue, and I said, listen, if you're listening to me right now and you're in prison, my question to you is, did you attend public school? And the answer, I'll just bet you, is going to be, yes, I attended public school, and I'm in prison. If you're unemployed right now, unemployed, you're looking for work, you lost your job, did you go to public school? And you're unemployed. All right? Well, the public school then didn't solve your unemployment problem, didn't prevent it. And the public school system didn't prevent your incarceration. And we got one more here. Are you on welfare? Are you taking food stamps, unemployment insurance? Are you on some form of public assistance out here? All right, if you are, did you go to public school? And if the answer to that is yes, you're proving my point, aren't you? Now, I know a bunch of you people are sitting out there saying, yeah, but I'm not on assistance, and I'm not unemployed, and I'm not in jail, and I went to public school. Well, boys and girls, not everybody that goes to public school ends up in prison, on welfare, or unemployed. I'm not suggesting that 100% of everybody that goes to public school, is going to end up unemployed. But let me put it to you this way. Would you suggest to your 19-year-old son that he go down to the local whorehouse? Now, I want to point out that not everybody that goes to the whorehouse gets venereal disease. I mean, I've been to the whorehouse, and I didn't get venereal disease. But I want to tell you that if you're looking for venereal disease, I don't think you can find a better place to find venereal disease than the local whorehouse. So it is true, you can drive your car at 80 miles an hour down the road, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be involved in an accident, but we know that speed kills. The faster you drive, and the longer you drive at this accelerated rate of speed, the more likely you are to get killed driving your car. I mean, if you want to test it, why don't you get after it? Drive 35 miles an hour, and then drive 45, 55. Pretty soon you'll get up to 110, 120, 140, 180. The faster you drive. Now, the people that drive slower last longer than the people that drive faster. That's what the Highway Traffic Safety Council tells us. And that's why they tell you, slow down, slow down, slow down. Well, if you hit a tree at 50 miles an hour, it tears up your car worse than if you hit the same tree at 30. All right, now, it's about break time here. I'm going to have to give you a break. Get your pen and paper out here, and then when we get back here, we're going to take a look at some statistics here. I'm going to show you what Zach Montgomery looked at. He looked at the census statistics from 1850, 60, 70, and 80. You can do that today. You can pull those up on Google. You can take these same numbers and extrapolate them out today. The only difference between the conclusion from 1886 and today is today it's worse than it was in 1886. You got more crime, more poverty, more insanity, more suicide, more violence, and more unemployment today than you had in 1886 per capita. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Let me give that to you once more. That's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can download that free general law CD package off our website by going to our archives page. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. And then finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. And they don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct. We'll talk to you. Call us direct here at 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book here called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. It takes up a pretty wild position. The position of the book is this, very simple. Public school causes criminals, poverty, insanity, suicides, violence, and unemployment. Causes it directly. And I'm going to show you how as we progress along. But that's a pretty wild statement to make. Now, it's true that not everybody who drives an automobile fast is going to get involved in a traffic accident and get killed. It is true that not everybody that goes to a whorehouse is going to get venereal disease, and it's true that not everybody that goes to public school is going to end up a criminal, poor, insane, a suicide, violent, or unemployed. But as a percentage of the whole, you will find that people who drive fast die young. People that go to whorehouses get venereal disease more often than people who don't. And people who go to public school turn out to be criminal, poor, insane, suicidal, violent, or unemployed more often than those that don't. So if you want to increase your chances of becoming criminal, poor, insane, suicidal, violent, or unemployed, go to public school. If you want venereal disease, go to the whorehouse. If you want to die young, drive faster. That's common sense. Now, in life, there are choices to make, and there are outcomes that come from those choices. So I'm not here to get you to take your kid out of public school. Remember, our program here is an educational service in public interest. And our job, our mission in life is we want to present both sides of the story. And then leave it up to you to make your own decision. The other day I was watching the McLaughlin group, and they were talking about the government's proposal here to take salt out of the food supply. Americans here in this country are consuming about 1.5 teaspoons of sugar per day. Excuse me, not sugar, salt per day. And the recommended amount is about 3/4 of a teaspoon. The government is going. They're putting the pressure on the food manufacturers now. You know, to take that salt out. About 80% of your salt intake comes from your processed and prepared foods and snacks and things like that. You know, salt on the potato chips. So they were sitting there talking, and the two conservative members of the panel, they were jumping up and down. They said, "Oh hell, that's just a nanny government again trying to butt into our lives and regulate us, and we resent it." And they got a woman on there. Her name is Eleanor Clift, and she's a writer. She's a reporter with Newsweek. And I mean, that woman is about as dumb as a box of rocks. She's so far to the left, I mean, she'd fall over sideways, you know, to the left. But once in a while, she comes up with a good line. And by God, she came up with a hell of a line. She said, "I'm all in favor of the government interfering in and enforcing the food processors to take the salt out. They should do that. And there's a very good reason why." And she said, "Because the government is now going to be responsible for paying for all of the health care costs of the American people. The government now has a vested interest in the health of the American people. And therefore, the people who eat more salt are going to cost more money to treat on the new health care plan." Which is exactly correct. It's exactly right, Eleanor. You hit the nail right on the head there. Now, the truth of the matter is, it would be good for the government to hammer on those corporations that the government has created to sell us all of this bad food to start with and to take the salt out. And that's because when I go into the restaurant and they put the salt in the food, I can't take the salt out of the food. But if the government will make them prepare the food and deliver it to me without the salt, I can always put my own salt on at the table. And this solves the problem for everybody. You see, it just solves everybody's problem. All right, now, getting back over here now to the results that come. You know, there's a result that comes from all of our actions, and there's a result that comes from this public school action. And so let's take a look at these results here. We find that the date referred to wit in 1860, Massachusetts and her five New England sisters had about 2.5 million native-born white inhabitants. And out of these, about 8,500 adults who could not read or write. So write that down. Massachusetts in 1860 had 2.5 million people, and about 8,500 of them couldn't read and write. That's about 1 out of 300, round numbers. Only one illiterate out of 300 people in the state of Massachusetts in 1860. That's a very, very admirable record for you people up in Massachusetts. Now, Virginia, with her five sisters, numbered about 3 million people, of whom 260,000 could neither read nor write. Now look at that. And that's 250,000 people out of 3 million people who can't read and write. So write that number down. That's about 1 in 12, about 1 out of every 12. So up in the New England states, there was only one illiterate up there out of every 300 population, and down in the parental states, there was one illiterate to every 12. Every 12th person was illiterate. All right, so that the six New England states, the proportion of illiterate native whites was only 1 in 300, while Virginia and her five sisters had one out of every 12. But now mark you, how stand the criminal lists? Now let's take a look at crime. Massachusetts and her five sisters, out of her native white population of a little more than 2.5 million, had on the 1st of June 1860, 2,500 people in prison, while Virginia and her five comparatively unlettered companions, with a native white population of 3 million, had about 500 in prison. That is to say, those educated under the New England system had one native-born white criminal to every 1,000 native white inhabitants, while those who had generally rejected that system but had one prisoner to every 6,500, being a disproportion, according to the whole number of native whites, of more than six criminals in New England to one in the other community. Now, that's a 6-to-1 difference. Now, a glance at the same table will show that the natives educated under the New England system had one pauper, that is, one poor person, to every 178, while those who had managed to live without that luxury had but one pauper to every 345. Now, that's a 2-to-1 ratio. All right, now here's what we're looking at here. Remember, we're comparing the New England system of education, that is, the compulsory, and everybody goes to school or else, to the parental system of the South, which says it's up to every parent to educate his own child. And we take a look at the illiteracy rates, and we find out that the people who are illiterate in the South have a 6-to-1 margin of criminality in their favor. In other words, there's six times more criminals in the North than there is in the South, and there's twice as many poor people in the North as there is in the South. Now, isn't it one of the tenets of the proponents of public education that if you're uneducated, you're going to end up poor because you won't be able to get a job? Well, let's think about this for a minute. The Amish people of America only go to the 8th grade, and they're very careful that these first 8 years are always conducted in Amish schools. And so those are Amish teachers in the Amish school, supported by the Amish people. And they only teach Amish there, see? So, I mean, they don't teach evolution in the Amish schools. They don't teach science in the Amish schools. They teach the Bible, and they teach morality. They teach Amish theology. They teach reading and writing and arithmetic. But they're not teaching communism there. They're not teaching the same curriculum there now in the Amish schools that they're teaching over here in your local public school. So that's number one. That's to protect the Amish way of life, their culture. Secondly, let me point out that here in America, the Amish people are the only people in America who can go to a public auction and buy a farm for $400,000 and open an attaché case and pay cash for that farm. There isn't anybody else in this country can do that. I mean, you know, just start asking all of you farmers out there listening to me right now, when was the last time you went to an auction and somebody just opened up an attaché case, bid $400,000 and paid cash? The Amish do it every day. Every day. I mean, those people, they're not bashful. So number one, they're not poor. And as a group, they're not poor. And as individuals, I haven't run across any poor Amish people. All the Amish people up here own land. They all own cattle. They're all productive. They're all working. They're all buying, selling, and trading. We got a pretty good-sized community. I might say there's probably 200, maybe. It could be 400. I didn't count them, but I'm going to guess that there's a couple hundred of them up there anyway in Seymour. Now, I'm not here, you know, to get you to join the Amish church. That's not our point here. But the Supreme Court of the United States made this observation in the Yoder case, in case you want to look that case up. It's cited at 406 U.S. 205. You ought to pull that one down off of a find law. It's 406 U.S. 205. It's called Jonas Yoder, State of Wisconsin Petitioner versus Jonas Yoder, Y-O-D-E-R. And here's what the Supreme Court came up with. It said, now look, the state of Wisconsin says if you don't send these children to school until they're 16 years old, they're going to end up in prison, poor, and unemployed. They looked all over Wisconsin. They couldn't find any Amish people in their prisons, couldn't find any Amish people in their unemployment lines, and couldn't find any Amish people in welfare. None. Zero. Now, I suppose that there's a couple of three poor Amish guys out there somewhere. I don't know. There may even be two or three of them that are unemployed. I don't know that either. But as a proportion of our population, and you take a look at the number of people in the Amish community and how many of them are in prison, then you take a look at the number of people in the straight community and how many of those are in prison, and the answer is 6-to-1. Only now it isn't just 6-to-1, it's more like 60-to-1. 60-to-1. And in 1886, it was 6-to-1. Now, boys and girls, that tells you quite a little story right there. Now, again, I'm not trying to tell you to take your kids out of public school, but if you want to increase your child's employability, his chances for suicide or insanity, poverty, and criminality, there's a thread that runs through this public school system. We're teaching these children a system, a standard of morality, a standard of life that lends itself to prison, poverty, insanity, suicides, violence, and unemployment. Now, that's just where reality is at. Now, let's take a look at another one here. Of those who in 1 year had died by suicide, New England had one to every 13,000 of the entire population, while Virginia and her five sisters had but one suicide to every 56,000. And of those who perished, the victims of their criminal lust, New England had one to every 84,000, while her neighbors had one of the educational advantage, had but one such victim to every 128,000. We have not before us the list of insane in the several states for 1860, so we borrow from the report furnished by the census marshal of 1870, where it appears that the New England system produced of those born and living in their native states, respectively, one insane person to every 800 native-born inhabitants, while the rejection of that system resulted in one insane to every 1,600 native inhabitants. That's a 2-to-1 ratio. So in crime, it's 6-to-1, and in poverty, it's 2-to-1. In suicide, it's 4-to-1. And in, let's see, what is this last one over here now? Insane, it's 2-to-1. Insanity, 2-to-1. Now remember, all these numbers in the tables are in the books here. They've got all the numbers here, if you want to know how many people lived in there. Well, here's, I'll just give it to you and tell you what the subject matter is. The proportion of insane born and living in the state. The proportion of native white paupers receiving state aid. Proportion of native white prisoners. Native white prisoners as of June 1st, the population native white, the population of the entire state. So they've got all the numbers in here from the census from 1850, and then they compare those to 1860, then they compare those to 1870, then compare those to 1880. And there was another corollary that came out of this. That was the costs involved, which is exactly where we're at today, and I've reported this to you a number of times, that here in the United States, when you take a look at how much does it cost to educate a kid in this country, I mentioned this to you last time, remember? It costs $10,700 on average to educate a kid in public school. And he scores at the 50th percentile. If you educate this kid at home, homeschooler, he'll score at the 86th percentile, and the cost is $550 a year. So it costs you 5% to get 60% smarter kids. And what happens here is the more money you spend, the dumber the kid gets. Well, listen, you take a look at this from 1850 to 1880, and exactly the same thing happened in that 30-year period. The more money these states spend on their public education system, the dumber the kids got. The difference is that they went from $3 a kid to $10 a kid, and the kid got dumber. Today we've gone from $10 a kid, now we're up to $10,700 a kid, and now they're even dumber yet. I could make a prediction here. If we were to double the education budget here in the United States, instead of spending $500 billion a year on our education system, which is obviously good because that's what we're doing, let's make it twice as gooder, and let's spend $1 trillion, $1,000 billion on public education. Wouldn't that be twice as good? And here's going to be the result. The children will score even poorer. They won't score at the 50th percentile anymore. They'll score at the 40th percentile. And we find that in the inner city public schools. You see, the national average is $10,700. But in the inner cities, they spend $14,000, $18,000, and $22,000, depending upon what city you're in, whether it's New Orleans, Washington, D.C., or Philadelphia. And then they score at the 28th percentile. So if you spend $10,700 on a kid, he'll score at the 50th percentile. If you spend $22,000 on the kid, he'll score at the 28th percentile. Now, we're being told that when we have a problem in our public schools, what we need to do is spend more money, hire more teachers, and have smaller class sizes. It has nothing to do with the overall outcome of the educational experience. Now, Zach Montgomery talks about good education and poor education. Well, I guess that's subjective and in the eye of the beholder. I'm just giving you the numbers that come out of the Department of Education today. And it is reported in a book called America to Pray or Not to Pray, another neat little book by David Barton. Now, David Barton, I'm going to give you a few citations here as we progress along here in the series, but this is called America to Pray or Not to Pray. I'll give him a plug here. By Wall Builder Press, Post Office Box 397, Aledo, Texas, 76008. Phone number down there is 817-441-6044. Again, that's 817-441-6044. Now, this is another little book here on education. They're really dynamite, just full of little neat notes and points. 160 pages, about like Zach Montgomery's, 140. And again, if you can't find that book or you forget David Barton, you can always get it from bravenewbookstore.com. Just call them up and tell them, hey, I'm looking for America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. They'll get it for you. That's what I like to do. Sometimes it takes damn much time, run around trying to find these books. Just get on the Brave New Bookstore and tell them, hey, I'm looking for this book. Can you find that for me? And they will. Now, in view of the foregoing facts and figures, is it any wonder that the Boston correspondent of the San Francisco Morning Call tells us that a large number of public schoolmen have come to the conclusion that the public school system of that city is a failure? Or is it surprising that another of our leading dailies, the Alta California, speaking editorially of the same system as it exists in this state, calls it our anaconda, and declares that if we are to judge this system by its apparent fruits, we shall have to pronounce it not only a melancholy, but a more disastrous failure, and that it will be idle to look for the cause of the general rowdyism, idleness, and viciousness of the rising generation anywhere but in the training which it has been receiving. Indeed, so infatuated has our young state become with this crime and pauper breeding system of public education in California, that California has made it a penal offense for the parent or guardian of any child between the ages of 8 and 14 years to keep such child from the public school, even for the sake of sending it to a far better private school of his own choice and at his own expense, unless he first seeks and obtains the gracious permission of the school directors to do so. But lest the reader should be disposed to doubt the existence of so tyrannical a statute, here it is, as enacted by the California legislature, dated March 28, 1874, and then they cite the California Compulsory Education Statute. Now, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to set you up here, and we'll see what we'll take a look at the next time over here, is this thing of the costs of these public schools back in the 1860s and the 1870s and 1880s, and what the results were. It's in Chapter 3, and it deals here with spending money, which is what we're being told today. Anytime there's a problem in public school, they tell you, well, we've got to spend more money. We need more teachers. We need smaller classes. We've got to spend more money. And we've heard that mantra, you know, for years and years. I've heard it all my life. And then the results of that, over the 60 years or 50 years that I've been watching this, is that it's getting poorer and poorer and worse and worse. And that's exactly what Zach Montgomery observed from 1850 to 1880. He says, the more money we spend on public school, the dumber the kids get, poorer the product. And the same thing is occurring today, only on a bigger, more massive scale. And so as time progresses along, we're going to spend more money, and we're going to get poorer results. And I just thought I would report it to you in advance so you can watch it occur right in front of your eyeballs. All right, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. And we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by